Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:11 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 3rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought that I would kick off today and look at some of the bigger picture macro indicators, because we're at a rather critical juncture for a number of asset classes, not least because Wall Street is right in the region of its peaks. There has been a significant move in the bond markets. Gold is right in the region of its trend mean. Oil prices have pulled back by the majority, or by the most we've seen since the beginning of January, and are at a rather important level where if support is going to be found, it would have to happen pretty soon. This was also a week in which China was closed for most of the week. Japan is also closed, won't open again until Monday for Golden Week and the Labor Day holiday. And there was a thinness in markets in Europe too because of a number of Labor Day holidays. So again, this is, I think, a rather interesting time to be thinking about where are we in the cycle, what is likely to happen next. So when we look at the total assets of central banks on a logarithmic scale from 2008 onwards, it did nothing but expand until about March of 2018. And the total went from approximately 7 trillion back in 2008 to a peak in excess of 20 trillion. And that's a lot of money. Even in today's world, that's still a lot of money. And it has been one of the contributing factors in the asset price inflation that has occurred over the same period. Well, obviously we've had a change in the last year. If we simply zoom in and just look at everything that's happened since March, well, what we're then presented with is this deterioration. There was certainly a trend of quantitative tightening going on all the way from March of last year, and we got a pop on the upside in November through to the end of January, but then the measure has continued to contract. Well, the ECB has ended its quantitative easing program, so they're no longer contributing additional new funds in as aggressive a manner. They are rolling over all of their expiring bonds, so that is not withdrawing liquidity from the market, and arguably there is the scope here for a bit of additional addition just by normal central banking activities, but it's not going up in nearly the same manner. The Federal Reserve is still engaged in quantitative tightening, and when we look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet, well, it has done nothing but go down. And the pace of that decline hasn't moderated one iota. It's just gone down in a very rhythmic manner. One of the things that investors had been hoping for earlier this week was that they would end this pace of quantitative tightening in June instead of September, and that was disappointed. That contributed to some of the volatility we had this year, or this week, I should say. But it's still going to end in September. So that's the silver lining, I suppose, would be the way to think about it. Well, one of the factors, then, if we have to think about it, that we had a significant contraction in the total assets of central banks in 2018 that corresponded with an uptick in volatility. That makes rational sense. So why haven't we had the same impact on markets in the first quarter of 2019, considering that we've had such an impressive move up in Wall Street in particular, and yet central bank assets have been contracting? Well, one of the reasons for that is because there has been a countervailing argument, which has been deficits. And I created this indicator by adding together and then redenominating to US dollars the deficits of all the major economies. So we can see that while central bank balance sheets were contracting in 2018, from June of last year we had a meaningful uptick in the size of deficits that economies were running. One of the limitations of this index is that a number of economies in Europe and indeed Japan only report these budget deficit figures annually. So we're going to get that's why it has been such a choppy indicator over the course of the last 17 years. But the more important point is that even in just the last couple of months, this indicator has gone from 600 to 800 billion. So there's been an additional 200 billion added in terms of deficit spending against a background where there has been a roughly similar amount taken out from central banks. And the Federal Reserve's quantitative tightening program is going to end in September. That represents a potential uptick in terms of that central bank measure because it's going to withdraw one of the factors from the calculation that had been contributing to the deterioration. So that's a positive. That's a obviously something that could contribute to additional asset price inflation if we continue to see liquidity measures starting to improve. If we look at other liquidity measures, well, something that people haven't really been talking about has been the TED spread. That was something that was really very fashionable to think about back in the period before the financial crisis because it had broken out in very emphatic manner. Well, one of the reasons that it's not being talked about right now is because it is almost at a new historic low. And that's a reflection of liquidity measures starting to ease up. So that's a positive. That's also, I think, one of the factors in helping the banking sector to do a little bit better in here. And the banks were quite volatile in here this week, but are finishing out the week in more positive territory. I think if we look at the weekly chart, we can see more clearly that we are now at new recovery highs over the course of the last 6 months, but much more important than that is the banks have broken the downtrend. It has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. We also have a higher reaction low. So while banks are lagging and lagging by a fairly considerable margin, they're not trending downwards. So at least that is a comfort for markets. Now, when we look at the regional banks index, which might arguably be considered to be a better arbiter of the domestic US economy. Well, there was a question about whether it was going to be able to push through the 200-day moving average in here this week, and it has finished out the week at right at the upper side of its range. Well, if it can push sustain a move, I guess, back above 110, then that is also going to suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So that is a positive. It does suggest that liquidity measures are easing up, that liquidity is starting to improve. Well, one of the other things that we saw in here this week was that copper prices pulled back really very sharply. And they were in positive territory in here today, and that is positive at least that it is finding support in the region of the low, excuse me, of the upper side of the underlying range. But it does have some work to do to repair the shock value of that downward dynamic we saw on Wednesday. So upside follow-through next week would certainly be positive. I think that if we start to think first about central bank actions and look at the individual central banks collectively, or excuse me, individually. The Federal Reserve is about to end its quantitative tightening. The ECB is on pause right now, but they are much more likely to engage in additional stimulus than not. China has not engaged in its monetary stimulus measures. Japan is still engaged in monetary stimulus. But when we then flip it around and look at fiscal stimulus, well, the USA is still engaged in fiscal stimulus. Deficit spending is very much a topic of conversation, and there is no end in sight to that. But when we think about the size of deficits, well, what we're presented with in China is something that is quite different to everywhere else. China is running a $552 billion budget deficit. And that measure has been ticking down successively over the course of the last 5 years. It's not updated particularly often. It's only once a quarter. And it's once a quarter with a quarterly lag, which means we're not really going to get a meaningful figure for the first quarter until the end of June. But the trend is downwards. And that is a really graphic representation of just how much of a fiscal stimulus China is engaged in. That has a clear reflationary impetus. Now, not least because what China has been doing has been weighing heavily on the bank, on the shadow banking sector. What they're now trying to do is limit any stimulative measures to the conventional banks and setting up programs for the banks to lend to the private sector. That's less important for the infrastructure sector as it is for smaller companies. And that's part of the reason why we're not getting a more vociferous welcome to this massive fiscal stimulus that's underway. What I think is worth keeping an eye on is the Shanghai Property Index. It did really very well in the first 3.5 months of this year. It has pulled back over the last while. Well, Chinese markets are going to be open again on Monday, and it would certainly be a comfort to investors if this one starts to rally again. If we have the Federal Reserve being the most important central bank, and China's government spending being perhaps the greatest source of fiscal stimulus, well, the strength of the dollar is the other really important arbiter in terms of global liquidity. We've had quite a lot of volatility in terms of the dollar's performance over this week, and it's not particularly often that we see the dollar index trading a full point over the course of 3 days. So I think we have to start to look at this broader trend. It certainly hasn't been particularly consistent. And it is coming back towards the upper side of the range around 100. There has been a broad loss of momentum over the course of the last 9 months. When we start to think about what has been the animating force behind dollar strength, it has been quantitative tightening. By reducing the size of the Fed's balance sheet, they have been reducing the supply of dollars to the international economy. That has resulted in competition for those dollars, which has inflated dollar pricing. I think that's a fairly solid rationale. But if the Federal Reserve is not going to be raising rates, and they are not going to be continuing with contracting the size of the balance sheet, then that removes some of the impetus behind why one would have to own dollars. And there is potential here that the price could start to come back down. Well, if the dollar starts to deteriorate, most particularly if it breaks through that 96 area and sustains a move below the trend mean, then that's going to be a significant tailwind for that central bank total assets measure. It's going to be an additional source of stimulus in terms of those deficits measures as well. But more particularly, it's also going to be a very significant bullish characteristic for gold. Gold prices were up about $8 in here today. They're continuing to demonstrate support in the region of the trend mean. And what it needs to do now is follow through on the upside. We've seen a number of occasions over the course of the last 3 months where we've had short-term rallies in gold that haven't been able to muster the wherewithal to break the downward bias. So we're going to have to see a clear upside follow through next week, And then a sustained move back above $1,300, that would break the progression of lower rally highs. It would also confirm more than near-term support in the region of the trend mean, and that would open the door then back towards a retest of the $1,400 area. And $1,400 represents the upper side of what is effectively a six-year base formation. So I think that is one of the more important characteristics. If this is in fact a base formation, then there's going to eventually be a catalyst to drive it up and out of the base formation. Well, I'm posting what I personally think is a very interesting article by Ray Dalio in Comment of the Day today, and I really do recommend reading it over the weekend. He has been making the point, and I very much agree with it, that MMT is going to, or modern monetary theory is inevitable. Quite apart from, or I think that's regardless of the fact that it may not be an especially great idea, or that it's potentially going to be mismanaged when it is eventually introduced. But the reality is if we just think about history, the US presidential cycle has been a significant factor in the stock market for decades, and there's a very solid rationale behind it, that in the first year of the presidential term, there had been a lot of stimulative measures underway to try and get the president elected. Then they clear the audience stables in the first 18 months. So that creates a bit of a downdraft. Then as you're moving into the third year, as people start to electioneer once more, the Federal Reserve had been tightening. They start to ease. And then you get to a point where there are stimulative measures starting to reappear again in the latter half of the third year and into the fourth year, and to lend a hand to the incumbent. And that had been such a reliable way of thinking about how central banking was moving in tandem with the political sphere, that it was a reliable way of looking at markets for decades. Well, we had a significant outlier in terms of the presidential cycle in 2008, because it was a down year for the S&P 500. But rather than focus on whether it is still a good indicator or not, and I do think it is really worth highlighting that in this latter half of it is the second half of the third year of the presidential cycle that we get the best returns. So that's, I think, a rather important characteristic. But the much bigger picture is that we have got decades of evidence already that there is an unspoken relationship between the Federal Reserve and the government. Now let's think about Japan. Well, it's quite simple that if we think about the influence that Abenomics had on the stock market, the low back below 10,000 in 2012, well, when we had Abenomics, which is basically a very clear agreement between the government and the central bank to act in unison, that is almost exactly what modern monetary theory is. It's a codifying of the previously unspoken relationship between the central bank and the government. Well, that had a profound effect on Japanese equities. The Nikkei doubled between 2012 and the beginning of 2015. And it then had a pullback, but it is now finding support in the region of the upper side of this base formation. 20,000, having been an area of resistance, is now an area of support. And that is one of the effects that we've seen from the adoption of this relationship between the central bank and the government. Well, Japan hasn't really embraced it to the same extent that is likely with the USA. But one thing that we also saw was that the clearest, if the stock market was one of the biggest beneficiaries, well, the devaluation that we saw in the yen, where the yen went from approximately 75 to 125 in the space of 3 years at exactly the same time that the stock market was rallying, that's a prelude to the kind of effect that modern monetary theory is going to have on currencies. If we're going to see the wholesale devaluation of currencies in order to fund social or infrastructure or pet projects by politicians, that's quite likely. And part of the reason that it's likely is because we're not so far away from the zero bound. If we look at the federal funds rate and just look at it on a very long-term basis, from the peak back in 1980, around 20%, there has been a rivetingly consistent sequence of lower rally highs, and the one exception was in 2000, and that was very quickly rescinded. The Federal Reserve is now on pause, and on each of the occasions that it goes on pause, it is usually a time when the stock market can do better. So if we then look at what's happened over the course of the last 20 odd years, we're presented with a rather interesting conclusion, because a lot of people have been paying a great deal of attention to the yield curve, and the yield curve is starting to expand once more. Although it did pull back into its range in the latter half of this week. Now the question is whether it is going to hold the majority of this breakout or whether it is going to go right back down and test that 10 basis point level. Well, what we had was a butterfly effect in the, or a butterfly trade is probably the better way to highlight it, in the yield curve. We had an inverted yield curve on the very short end from the 3 month to the 10 year or even the 30 year, but not on the 10 year. This has not inverted. Now, I think it's useful to look at these liquidity measures because they give us a lead indicator to future problems. What I think is also worth highlighting is if we look at this measure on a longer term basis, it isn't in fact the yield curve inversion that tells us that we're at the top of the market. When the market peaked in, or when we had the yield curve inversion very briefly in 1998, it gave us a 2 year lead indicator. Well, I guess that's not quite true. It was an 18-month indicator for the peak in the markets. And that was very similar. We had a mild inversion in 2005, and the real problems started in 2007. Well, what we can also therefore conclude, it isn't so much when the yield curve becomes inverted, but rather after the inversion, when it starts moving higher in an aggressive manner, that is usually in response to a significant problem. So that's certainly something that we can pay attention to. And the reason that the yield curve starts to expand like that is because the Federal Reserve is cutting interest rates. Well, if we look at the overlay of the S&P 500 with the Fed funds rate, we can see that on occasions when they do stop raising interest rates, the market can continue to rally. And that was particularly true back in 2006, because they paused interest rates for nearly 2 years, and the market went on a tear. It went up about 25 or 30%. It isn't until the Federal Reserve actually cuts interest rates that markets really run into trouble. So the most benign scenario is that they continue to pause. The longer they pause for, the better that is likely to be for stock markets. It is when they start, it looks increasingly likely, and the market starts pricing in the potential that they're going to cut rates, then that is when the market really does come through with a significant risk. Well, how do we then measure the outlook for whether they're going to cut rates or not? Well, the 2-year yield has been stable around the 2.2% level over the course of the last few weeks, but it is still a downtrend. And what that is suggesting is that the bond market is pausing in here, but they haven't yet concluded that the risk of an interest rate cut has been completely removed from the table. What they have certainly concluded, though, is that we are at the top of the interest rate cycle, and they are not pricing in any rate hikes for the foreseeable future. Well, what that suggests is that there's potentially going to be a lengthy pause in terms of the Federal Reserve. And that does hold out the prospect that we could have a bubble evolve. The Federal Reserve is a serial bubble blower. We had a meaningful pullback last year, and the index is now right in the region of its peak. I've been of the view that we are due some consolidation. Well, we had 2 days of consolidation this week, and now the market is back up at its peak. I'm not quite willing yet to walk away from that prediction that we're going to have at least some consolidation. I do think that there is a short-term overbought condition, and that there is potential here for some additional easing. But one thing that we are getting is that productivity growth is picking up, and it is not trending higher in a sustained manner, but it is the highest level of productivity we've seen since 2014. And there are the other way of thinking about that is productivity growth is one of the most sought after aspects to justify a secular bull market, because it allows asset prices to appreciate without and because the efficiency of the economy is improving without inflation. So that's a very significant factor. But what's it being driven by? Well, I think we have an easy answer for that. That when we think about what is driving this efficiency gains, it's the cloud computing sector. And the First Trust Cloud Computing ETF has been a clear outperformer over the course of the last 4 months. So that's a very emphatic rebound, and it is still going. So cloud computing is about automation, but it's also about artificial intelligence and deep learning. And those are remarkably significant in terms of stock market performance, but also in terms of driving the efficiency in the economy. So that's obviously a very significant factor. Right now, the other big source of innovation is in the healthcare sector, but the biotech sector has not been performing to nearly the same extent as cloud computing for one rather important reason, and it's pricing. They are seeing a great deal of resistance coming through to pharmaceutical pricing. And because it is rather expensive to develop these new drugs, and it can take rather a long time to do so, then companies tend to pass on those costs to consumers. But when we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars for treatments, then that obviously meets with some resistance. It also creates this populist backlash, and politicians like to capitalize on that, and that has represented a headwind. What we're also starting to see, though, is that the catalyst for interest in cybersecurity has finally started to emerge, and that has translated into the sector breaking on the upside. The catalyst that I've been waiting for and looking out for at least the last 5 years has been some form of motivation to force companies to start to defend their data. It just simply has not been in the interests of corporations to do so because they were insured, and it was cheaper to endure a hack and a theft of their data than to defend against it. But what insurance companies are increasingly using as a rationale for not paying on those insurance policies is that they don't pay out on war damage, and they are categorizing it, cybercrime, as terrorist activity and a war, and they're not paying the insurance claims as a result. That is manna from heaven for the cybersecurity companies, because it's going to force large corporations to get more serious about defending their data, and which is effectively a consumer's data. So that's good news for consumers as well. And that is now one of the factors that is going to likely contribute to cybersecurity doing better from here. And that's, I think, a rather significant catalyst. Well, then of course we have automation. And automation is most particularly evolving in the transportation sector. We're going to have Uber's IPO next week. We've already had Lyft's IPO, but the leaders in terms of automation are Google and Tesla. Well, Google's Waymo service is not generating any revenue right now, and it is not really incorporated in the share. The price pulled back really very violently on their earnings in here this week. So it's going to have to hold the $1,000 area, and we're probably going to get at least some pause of consolidation in here for the share. But if Google gets to be the first company to commercialize autonomous level 5 driving, then that is going to be a catalyst for growth similar to the Google search engine. And that is something I think is probably going to contribute to the share continuing to hold on to the majority of its advance. Then Tesla was up about $10 in here today, and this is looking increasingly like a failed downside break. Well, a failed downside break suggests that it could, if it can break this sequence of lower rally highs, push back up to the upper side of this range. And the upper side of the range is just south of $400. Tesla is pushing out cars today that it says have the capability to drive on their own. Well, obviously that's an awfully bold claim, and we'll see whether they can in fact deliver upon that, but there is no doubt that they are gathering an enormous amount of data from the cars that are on the road right now. I do think that if we're thinking about the kinds of catalysts for a secular bull market, then the continued march of technological innovation, the fact that we're starting to now get that productivity growth coming through, is one of the most compelling bullish arguments that we have. if we go back and think about all of the other secular bull markets that we've experienced in over 100 years, they have all had a technological innovation aspect to them. So that's a very meaningful change. Now, we can't really talk about the rise of technology without paying due consideration to oil. Well, the oil price was pulling back for most of this week, and it has stabilized in here today. But this is a larger pullback now than we've seen over the course of this move upwards since January. It absolutely needs to hold the $70 area. If it fails to do that, then we are going to be moving into a more volatile period and obviously less easy to monitor from a chart perspective. So I think that's an important consideration. But the much bigger consideration is to look at oil on a very long-term logarithmic scale. And if we go back and look at not simply the last 20 years, but the last 120 years, what we're presented with are cycles. And the price goes in these very long-term cycles. So regardless of how the price moves in the short term, it's really rather unlikely that we're going to see oil prices sustain a move above $100 for the foreseeable future. And that is obviously going to have some exceptions if we have geopolitical tensions. But the fact that we now have a condition where the world's largest importer has become a net exporter is a profound change. Personally, I filled up my my tank yesterday and paid $4 a gallon for oil, and we haven't se or for gasoline, and we haven't seen that price for at least the last few years. Oil is still a tax on consumers. The lower the price is, the better it is for the consumer. But the innovation that we have with unconventional oil and gas, hydraulic fracturing, and horizontal drilling, well, that has had the most profound effect on natural gas. Natural gas prices are in a long-term base, and they're likely to remain in this long-term range for the foreseeable future. The price is likely to be ranging between $2 and $4 for perhaps the next decade. Well, what that is also going to do is to create new use cases. That is exactly what we have learned from the Jevons paradox, that these kinds of massive, impressive moves in technology create new use cases. The fact that you now have hydrogen fuel cell cars on the road is, I think, a competing, or at least a competing or complementary technology to electric vehicles. What it does do, though, is puts massive pressure on the establishment companies that were building internal combustion engines. Because when we look at the fortunes of some of Germany's car manufacturers, well, they are rallying at the moment, and they have broken the downtrends for all of last year. But they are going to have to spend a pile of money to get back to a position where they are competitive. The vast majority of batteries are going to be produced in Asia. The largest car companies are in future are probably going to be Asian, and the biggest markets for cars are going to be in Asia. These are massive challenges for Germany, and where you have demographic decline right across Europe, then they need to create products that are going to be of use to new markets, and those markets are going to be in Asia and increasingly in Africa. And that's going to require a massive retooling. Well, one of the reasons why the constituents of the DAX have collectively been doing not especially well is because of their inability to be nimble. But the MDAX has been rallying, and it has at least been able to sustain a move back above the trend mean, and it continues to improve upon that. Now, the bigger question is whether a resumption in some demand for the euro is going to act as a headwind for European markets. There is a potential that a lot of the bad news that people are worried about with regard to Europe is already in the price. We're starting to see that peripheral markets like Greece and Portugal and Spain are improving. And as long as that remains the case, well, what that suggests is that we are seeing I think, a return to demand dominance. But the much bigger question is whether that can persist if we get a more meaningful move in the euro. The euro has been really quite volatile over the course of the last week, and it put in a higher reaction low in here today. If it sustains a move above 113, then it will have broken this downtrend since January. If it sustains a move above the trend mean, then it will have broken the downtrend since January of 2018. And that would be a very meaningful move. It would be, I think, really quite bullish for the precious metals. It would be bullish for the industrial resources. But it would potentially then start to change the outlook for the European markets, because the exporters have been the clearest outperformers in Europe. The precious metal companies are, excuse me, not precious metals, but luxury goods companies in Europe have been the clearest outperformers. They've benefited most from the weakness of the euro. Its domestic plays are likely to be the biggest beneficiaries from a strengthening euro. And that will represent a significant change in the outlook for the European markets. Well, when we look at the Euro Stoxx index, it is coming back up towards this 400-point level. But I do think that there is potential here that if we do get markets breaking on the upside, it's quite likely that the upper side of this range is going to be exceeded. We're also getting increasingly close to a resolution to the Brexit impasse. And the pound, having trended down from the peak around 145 in 2015, now has first step above the base characteristics, and it rallied really quite impressively in here today. So what that is beginning to highlight is there is a clear potential that politicians have got an incentive. They've seen what the reaction has been to the local elections, and now they know with, I think, clarity that unless they come up with some form of agreement to get Brexit over the line, or to bring the entire episode to a conclusion before the next election, then the Conservatives and the Labour Party are likely to be eviscerated in the next election. People are just fed up with the inability of Parliament to deliver on a solution to this rather divisive issue. And Brexit's important, but it is obviously not the only thing that is that needs to be addressed in the UK economy at present. I continue to think that it is quite likely that the people who voted for Brexit are going to be, and the result of the referendum is going to be betrayed. that the UK is going to remain closer to the EU than anyone thought they were voting for. And that is what the exchange rate is telling us. So that's, I think, a meaningful move in here that we've seen. But what it also helps to highlight is there is a clear institutional move towards a federal Europe, and that is likely to persist almost indefinitely. Well, when we then go back and think about the outlook for the bond markets, well, the German 10-year yield was in negative territory back in March. It's at 2 basis points right now. This, I think, is one of the points that Ray Dalio was also making, is that when you do get the next recession, Europe and Japan have nowhere to go. They can't lower interest rates any further. So they're going to have to do something else. They're going to have to engage in some form of modern monetary theory or something extraordinary. It could potentially be cancelling debts. It could be anything, any number of an extraordinarily large number of potential extraordinary measures. Measures that were once considered impossible suddenly become possible at the zero bound. That is something that is really, I think, one of the most important considerations. That when it gets down to this view that central banks are pushing on a string, that they've gone as far as they can go, that they have nowhere left to go, that's short-sighted. There is an infinite number of possibilities that can be adopted when you control the currency. But the likelihood is that all of them are going to result in the value of those currencies falling. Well, the other way of thinking about it is that it means asset prices will go up. So we have two big rationales for why there is likely to be a secular bull market. The first is that we have technological innovation. We have change in the energy sector. And then, of course, we also have the massive source of new workers coming through from the emerging markets, where in India you have approximately 600 billion people, million people, excuse me, 600 million people that are going to be entering the workforce within the next decade. So that's an incredibly significant number. You don't quite have the same number of workers coming through in China any longer, and that represents a challenge for their market. And that is one of the reasons why they are so aggressively pushing for automation and the technological innovation and greater efficiency in their own economy, because they just don't have the large numbers of young workers any longer. But those are the bullish factors. But you can't have a bull market without a source of liquidity. And modern monetary theory represents that source of additional liquidity. So we can look at the fact that the Federal Reserve is on pause. That generally speaking, it is when they come off pause and cut interest rates is when central bank or when and the reason they do that is because there is a problem that has evolved in the economy that needs to be addressed. So they start cutting rates. That is generally when stock market investors really do start to sell. The inverted yield curve can have a lead indicator for anything up to 2 years, but when the central bank starts to cut interest rates, then there is no lead indicator. That's a coincident indicator with the completion of a top. At least that has been the what we've seen in the last two cycles. Well, then we know what the response will be. There's likely to be a bear market. but it's likely to be a cyclical bear market within the secular bull market. We just haven't had one of those in at least a decade. Then we get massive sources of new liquidity coming through. And that is potentially then something that is going to power this bull market through all the way through until the early or the mid 2030s. That is what the Dow gold ratio is telling us. That if we look at this ratio over the very long term, then it has got a very clear message that when oil prices peak, then stock markets tend to do better. That stock market bull markets relative to commodities have been successively more impressive since the 1920s, and that there are approximately 35 years between the peaks. Well, the last peak was in 1999, which means that the next peak is going to be somewhere around 2034. And that's what we can anticipate from the secular bull market hypothesis. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.